Okay. Are we good? So, let's look at this. I just wanted to remind you, you know, we sent out that email, and then plus it was on the webpage, this free neuroscience textbook, neurophysiology textbook. Some of the figures, you might recognize them. They were straight out of those web pages, right? I just copied and pasted. Some of the questions from that free neurophysiology place, I just copied and pasted some of the multiple choice questions, right? So this is kind of why we put that out there, too, right? So you have it to look at. All right. So, hopefully you can look at that first page and figure out what's going on there. And, you know, kind of go through that. So the second page, where we started with, so everybody got the first page and all four sections the same pretty much. The second page, where we start with that essay question. So all the sections have different questions. The first one, I think, was Eaton-Lambert syndrome, which is a autoimmune disease to your voltage-gated calcium channels in your presynaptic motor nerve terminals. What do you think would happen if you have an autoimmune disease to your voltage-gated calcium channels in your motor neurons? Presynaptically. When you stimulate, there's an action potential comes down, the calcium channels don't open up, right? You're heating them up, so you can't release transmitters. Then the other one was the section two, we had a question with, remember Brain on Fire? We talked about with NMDA receptors antibodies. Well, there was the other one where you have antibodies to your GABA receptors. Wow. And that's kind of neat, but in that same category, they kind of call that, there's also antibodies to the enzyme that makes GABA. So the GAD, glutamate decarboxylase, you can make antibodies that then you can't make GABA. So what would you think if you had either antibodies to your GABA receptors or antibodies to the synthesis of GABA, what's going to happen? Yeah, no inhibition, so all you get is excitation. So then your big muscles, you know, you're going to contract and state, so they call it stiff man syndrome. They should call it stiff person. You can gender, you know, terrible, right? And so it's actually stiff person. They're trying to rename it stiff person syndrome. So you can imagine that's a pretty interesting thing. Think about this. Every protein in your body, you could have autoimmune disease. Every protein in your body. Now, what do you think would happen to you if you had an autoimmune disease to your sodium-potassium pump, for example? You're gone, right? But you do have different sodium potassium pumps in your heart versus your nervous system. There's a little different isoform, and they work differently on drugs. But you can imagine, right? I think I mentioned this before. We're going to see some at the outreach center. Now, there's different reports out, but another report came out that one-third of all pregnancies end up in spontaneous abortion. And now, in some studies, it's even higher, like maybe 50% or over 50%. Depends on smokers and, you know, diet and all that kind of stuff, wherever they do these studies. But still, you think about a third spontaneous abortions after you've been through, so it kind of makes you think about it all, too. But then you wonder, why? Well, maybe there was some defect in the calcium channel, maybe a defect in the sodium channel, maybe the heart didn't develop. That's not going to allow that fetus to develop. So it shuts it down, right? Or maybe vasoconstriction, the mother took some other medications that cause vasoconstriction, doesn't do good to the blood supply, all kinds of things. But just think about these kind of things. So this question that you had was myasthenia gravis, an autoimmune disease to antibodies that destroys the nicotinic, so be real careful, some people answer the question a little bit crazy, about nicotinic acetylcholine receptors, and it says junction between the nerve and skeletal muscle. Some people went off about the nervous system, central nervous system. This says neuromuscular junction, okay? So read it for neuromuscular junction. So what do you think is going to happen if you can't use your acetylcholine receptors? You can't have neuromuscular junction. That means your muscles aren't going to be working, right? So it's really quite bad. And you can imagine over time then, if you can't work your respiratory muscles, what's happening? You know, you're not going to breathe and you're going to have problems. So you can imagine. So there's a lot of extra information, but to try to give it full, the main key words were neuromuscular junction, nicotinic receptors, antibodies, right? Okay, so that's that one. So you got a lot of points to kind of, people went off in different ways and answered this. This might have been a little hard for some other classes. We had it as a multiple choice, but I tried to make them all equal about difficulty and different questions to choose. People should know what primary, secondary, with this hemoglobin. I even wrote hemoglobin on the bottom, right? Or something, hemoglobin, to give you a hint, right? Quaternary. What's tertiary? It's not here. Yeah, one of those subunits may be folding together and having a cysteine-cysteine double bond, I mean a bond between the sulfide groups, right? And that could be a tertiary. Remember the other one that's not shown on here? Alpha helix, which is another secondary, right? Okay, so things to kind of remember. Those kind of questions are on standardized exams too. So this was just working out 200, and it said outside over inside, so you just had to remember that 200 over 20, and then, you know, 10 over 1 is 1, and 58, right? Hopefully you figure that out if you missed it. Okay, this is straight out of that neurophys question, and what we were looking for, if you read this in SN1, SN2, it's not really a refractory period. Why is it not refractory? These are the same size, right? And these are recording action potentials in S1 and S2. So those are there, and you see that they're not different in sizes. But what's happening? S1's being stimulated, boom, boom. S2 gets stimulated. You see that synaptic response. Remember, these are graded responses. This is not an action potential up here. This is a graded response in that neuron. And all right, and then what happens here? S2 and S1 stimulated at the same time, and we got a bigger response. So what are we looking at? S1 and S2 are two different locations. So it's summation, but it's spatial summation, right? What if it was S1 repetitively, real fast? Then it's temporal summation. So the other class had a temporal summation, one, and you had a spatial summation on this. So that's spatial summation. There was other questions about residual calcium where you gave two responses close together, and the second one was much bigger than just added for the first one. That's residual calcium. That's called short-term facilitation, right? STF. So it's not just some. It's more than some, right? That's facilitation. So that could be presynaptic mechanisms with residual calcium. Okay. How to determine tau for a cell and determine the theoretical, you know, you would put some theoretic voltage in there and do a trace. So all we wanted to do, it didn't matter if it was rise tau, I don't think we said it, rise or decay, it didn't matter. It's just give a current injection, right? And then draw, you know, in case you can't see over there, you can move your chairs, do a rolling thing. You know, you do a current injection and you measure the voltage. And you can either do the decay or the rise, it didn't matter. You know, let's say that's 100 millivolts. This is 63 millivolts. This is tau rise. And you could do the time it takes to drop 63% and only 37% remaining. And this is tau decay. Right? So it was just inject current, measure the voltage trace, and either measure the time it takes to get to 63% or the time it decays to get to 63% remaining of 37, right? So the decay of 63. That's all there was. Just inject and look at the traces. And you can do. Now, the other class had a question. Why would rise tau be different than decay tau? Or was that this class? I don't know. I'll have to look. Why might it be different? Any ideas? The injected current, you got a voltage, it changed, but decay tau, sometimes, that's why they separate these, decay tau might be much different. Maybe it comes down really fast, and decay tau is very short. Any ideas why that could be different, possibly?
Is it based on the concentration of potassium,
It could be, exactly, you could open up different channels while you've been depolarized. You could open up some voltage-gated potassium channels, and it's going to try to come back down. It might still be open because they don't close right away, right? They have, some of those could be sluggish. Lots of things could happen, but basically the resistance times what makes tau? Resistance times capacitance. Usually capacitance isn't changing, the resistance is changing, which is due to channels, right? Channels. Resistance channels. Okay. Oh, this one I screwed up, so I gave it to you, right? And it probably gave you lots of anxiety during the exam. Because basically what I meant to do is to erase this no flux, no net flux on the sodium ions. the point I was trying to make on this one that I screwed up by having that sentence still there was if we had a pump on one side, like side one, and we're pumping sodium into the cell, right, these are cells, then what would happen on the other side if it's permeable to sodium? It could go across, right, because you're pumping it this way. And then what might follow, water might follow, for example. It was basically setting it up like that. So wherever the pump is where the driving gradient is pumping against the loading up the cell. But if you're permeable on the other side, then you can get the sodium to go down a concentration gradient. This is an example of a frog skin. A lot of this has worked in frog skin. How our kidneys work was actually done understanding a lot in the frog skin. Because a frog, fresh water, what happens to their water inside the body? If you put a frog that has salt and all that in fresh water, what's going to happen? Think of a red blood cell going in fresh water. What's going to happen? It swells, right? So the animal's having to fight that all the time. So actually, it tries to pump out the salts. And so it doesn't swell up, right? And it maintains its osmolarity because the skin's permeable to this water, and that's how they can get water too. And they can actually breathe through their skin, right? They don't need everything with lungs, so it's really important for them to keep all that. So anyways, I screwed that up, so you all got points. And some of reading through the questions, I could see that a lot of you are on the right track with the pump, but it was confusing because of the way the givens were. So everybody got points on that one. So this class has got a little average that's a bit higher than the others because of this. Okay. So people should get this one down, right? Adaptation, evolutionary process, like over time, right? And then there were the other ones too, acclimatization, right? And so this is within the lifetime, acclimation, within the animal, but like in the lab experiments, so you can get that one down. Okay, so what happened here? We gave some partial credits for different things. So here, on ion channels being selected for different types of ions, different charges and sizes. Some of you just kind of reworded because different charges and sizes, there was a difference. But, you know, why is it potassium does not travel through a sodium channel or a chloride channel? So there's different ideas. What could it be? It could just be the size of the ion itself, right, with the size of the pore. That's okay. But what else goes around ions that we talked about? The hydration sphere, exactly. So the hydration spheres could be different, right? So that makes a big difference. And the charge of the channel can repel or attract chloride or positive ions, depending on the charge. The glycoproteins, even outside the channel, select kind of the ions that go around the mouth of the channel. That's kind of cool, too. But just that you would get the general ideas, that's where we were going with that. Okay, and then the Nernst equation and Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz equation. Anybody got a tattoo yet for extra credit? No one got a permanent tattoo, Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz? So some people might have forgot that, or some people, I don't know which class, but we always have these questions on every exam, is that the Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz permeability, right? Nernst equation doesn't take into effect that, but basically sets an equilibrium potential. If the membrane's permeable, then you'll set up and figure out where the potential is. Some people forgot that it's a solid line underneath the denominator and numerator instead of plus, 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 right? It's the whole line across there. So go back and look at that. Write your tattoo in your arm so you won't forget it. That kind of stuff. It's really important. Goldman-Hodgkin-Katz. And what did we learn from this? We learned a lot, right? We learned about potential gradients for ions to move when the membrane is permeable, where the membrane is going to go to. We learned the shape of the action potential. We learned how your kidneys work, we learned how your heart's working, we learned how pacemakers work, everything, right? Your body, any cell that's electrically excitable and things. So just so many things to learn about. Okay, so how can we get energy in the form of ATP from fats, lipids compared to glucose? The PASS. So if you remember that PowerPoint, there was one PowerPoint that you might remember. We had fat on one side breaking down. I told you didn't have to memorize all the pathways, but you know, went through a fatty acid cycle, broke it down, and went into the TCA cycle. The other one was glucose, what I call it the TCA electron transport chain. The other one was proteins broken down to what? Amino acids, right? And those amino acids can enter in the TCA cycle in different places. Sometimes in a biochemistry class, I don't know if they're torturing you here with this, but they actually have you work with different amino acids to know where they might enter the TCA cycle, and you have to figure out how much ATP you get out of that. No, that's crazy stuff. But sometimes the biochemists get crazy. All right, so we should kind of go know that. So we've talked about ways that we can change the membrane, right, to condition, to cold or warm. Old exams might have been just the opposite, warm or cold. Some people get them backwards or they're confused. But the main thing, what are we talking about? You know, the bilipid membrane, right? If it's nice like that, with unsaturated, it's nice and tight, Van der Waal forces decrease lipidity. Start to have double bonds, right? Unsaturated, right? And then you get kinks and then increased lipidity. Cholesterol, the little rug rat, you go in the kindergarten room, you can't move. Now, I know that was a little confusing because you're supposed to talk about that in class in physiological terms, in the physiological range for animals to raise that cholesterol. It's basically decreased. If you can go to the extremes, and you know, like in a lab or bacteria, you can get some other aspects. The other way, what was it? Not just the same length carbon chains, but if you had different length carbon chains, right? And so you can get different length carbon chains, and that increases lipidity. Okay? Those kind of things.
All right. But we got to kind of know those things down. Okay. What's happening at the threshold here, generally?
Voltage-gated sodium channels opening up, right? So, and explain what's going on, and why does it not reach the E-sodium? Two main things.
Sodium channels become
inactivated, and? Potassium channels open on the rise, which is counteracting the sodium coming in. So the two main things why you're not reaching E-sodium. And then hopefully everybody remembered, it's not really the transmitter, it is the receptors that make you. But generally, right, GABA is inhibitory, and generally glutamate is excitatory, but it's not always the case. Actually, when you're in development, at least in other mammals, probably us too, that early in development, in parts of your brain, the GABAergic synapses are actually excitatory because the chloride potential hasn't built up yet. And you can actually even see that fruit fly neurons that are going through development early on until the potentials have worked out and got a steady state. So, again, you know, it depends on the receptors of what's going on. Okay, some people got confused with tau and lambda on this.
And then why you chose this location. Remember, this is straight out of the PowerPoints from lecture. This is a cell membrane. And that's right, you know, left everything there. Cell interior, cell exterior, membrane. This is not the cytoplasm in the cell. This is just a membrane, right? So where it drops 63%, you know, somewhere up here, why would we choose that? You know, yeah, that's lambda, right? So where it drops 63% of whatever this amplitude was. And it's up there somewhere. If you drew somewhere in there, you've got points for it.
Lambda is the length constant of where the potential will drop 63%, whatever the initial start was. So if we had a long cell like this, and we injected current right here, and we measured as we go along, we would measure different potentials. If that's 100 millivolts, you measure again, where it drops, where you only have, you know, 37% or whatever it is, that is, if that's 100 millivolts, that's over 37 millivolts. So it's a distance from here to there, right? So it's distance, okay? Not time constant. So people get confused with that.
Okay, so this one was a little bit maybe hard to understand at first. Figures, but we talked about this patch clamp, got the Nobel Prize. And hopefully everybody's got some points in this, why that was so important. Figuring out how single channels work, then you could understand how the whole cell folded together. You could understand some, you know, and I know we didn't go into it a lot in class, but open time, close time, how much current goes through a single channel, right? It's all kind of here, how much current goes through a single channel. Then you know how many channels it would take to get above threshold, for example. Our open times, our wind inactivation, or what kind of ions go through, all kinds of things. That's why they got a Nobel Prize for the technique, because they figured out how single channels work. They can even do this over receptors, right? And put like acetylcholine on a receptor and watch it open up, and then you realize sodium and potassium is going through. And did it show inactivation or not?
you know, did it stay open the whole time when you're doing the square pulse? You remember this one was the sodium channels that show inactivation after they open, they've closed. So lots of different answers you could have on that one. Okay, so we kind of talked about this in class at once. If you stimulated a nerve right here, the nerve, it's going to fire that way, right? Down to the nerve terminal. It's going to fire also back up to the cell body. So hopefully we got that down. But why might it be bad going back up to the cell body and this dendritic free? Is it normal to have the action potential that big of a voltage going up that way? Normally it goes down and it's not going to go back up because of the refractor period, right? So the dendrites would never see that kind of large voltage like an action potential. And a cell body is probably never going to see that kind of large potential either, right? So that's a lot of voltage coming across there. So you can answer this in multiple ways. You might open all the channels that are there that normally wouldn't be open, for one thing, right? Because they never see that kind of voltage, because it's not normal to have that kind of large action potential going up in the cell body and the dendrites. And what else might happen? You know, think about the, and I know we didn't, I think one person got into that, and I don't know if this class or not. You have NMDA and AMPA receptors, right, for glutamate transmitter. Remember, the AMPA receptors open with voltage dependence, right? So, I mean, if the glutamate goes onto it, they open, and calcium, mostly sodium goes in, some calcium, mostly sodium. And then as the membrane depolarizes, what happens to the NMDA receptor? Undoes that chloride plug, right? Or the magnesium, some people say, but it's just plug. Kicks out that negative charge because the membrane's now changed. And now when you release glutamate, you activate both NMDA and AMPA receptors. But what if you had an action potential come up and already kick out the plug, the negative charge, and now you have both receptors waiting for glutamate, but you never had glutamate the first time. Now you're going to have both receptors ready to go, right? Well, it's not normal for the dendrites to have that type of response. So people are still questioning about that therapy that they're doing on people, like if you had a cut nerve, they put little pack-packs on you and they stimulate the nerve, hoping that it could cause regeneration. But there's still studies going on in mice that say, that might not be so good. But you want to keep the muscle healthy so it doesn't atrophy, so the nerve will grow to the muscle, and you can recover quicker if the muscle doesn't atrophy, right? Because when your muscle atrophies, it's going to take a lot longer for rehabilitation. Your peripheral nerves will grow about a millimeter a day. The problem is getting them directed to the right location. So they actually do nerve grafts and things like that to get them to go to the right location. So it's really quite neat. But stimulating could be problematic, and so there's controversy in the literature still today about this. Okay. So hopefully we got this idea about speed of conduction, right? They all can change. All these have an impact on it, right? Myelination capacitance, remember, it has to neutralize. That's why the myelination, you take away that capacitance so you can jump, sulfur conduction. Acetylcholine is released by exocytosis with vesicles fusing. Okay, this was hopefully a given, you know, negative feedback processes. And when this was an osmolarity, another given for you, kind of put salt on a slug, right? What's going to happen? Salt water's going to come out of that animal, right? This is the high salt that you put on the snails. So if you want to torture your snails in the garden, there you go. Okay, and repolarization to open up the voltage-gated potassium channels. Well, membrane depolarization. And here we go about different regions on the dendritic tree. Different regions are temporal summation, right? Same region repetitively is temporal summation, right? So spatial and temporal. That's what we were trying to get out of that. Okay, in a cell movement, molecules from an area of low concentration to high concentration. Well, I saw that in some textbooks it's a little bit confusing the way they talk about it. But either way, it requires cellular energy. I gave you points for that. R, if you chose cellular energy and facilitated transport, you got points for that too, because some texts, they actually go both with this. It's okay. So basically, if you get the main gist of this. Okay. Quantal hypothesis. Dr. Katz, how did he come up with this experiment, and what did he do? Remember, it was neuromuscular junction. You record in that neuromuscular junction. Without stimulation, what did you get? Minis, right? Spontaneous events. is little amplitudes. So what did he do? He measured the amplitudes of the minis. Did a histogram of those. Then he stimulated the nerve and recorded evoked responses, right? Sub-threshold. So the graded responses. Maybe only had one vesicle released this time. Or maybe had two vesicles released, or three vesicles released, or four. But as long as it was sub-threshold. Then he did that many, many, many times. And then you could plot the amplitudes of these different events that you got. And he could do it in low calcium, or high cadmium, or high magnesium, or maybe Carrara, anything to keep it sub-threshold. So when he measured the range of these evoked events, he realized it's a unitary measure of the spontaneous events. So then he said, oh, the spontaneous events must make up the evoked events, right? That's the Bernard Capping term. Very important to remember, that's the basis of synaptic transmission of every animal, every synapse in your body, how your brain works, how every animal is working, right, in synaptic transmission. So that's the fundamentals with that. All right, what else are we up to here? Oh, design an experiment of squid axon and how you might measure the shape of the action potential. You could have gone all different ways with this, right? Put it in the bath, change the sodium, change the potassium. Basically, you could record in different locations. Look at the shape of the action potential, why you vary, either intracellular. The big key was with the squid. It was so big, it's like the size of your pinky. You could squish out the cytoplasm, you could tie it off, you could put different solutions on the inside. You know, high potassium, high sodium, high whatever calcium. You could do those experiments and put it into a solution that you can control, and you could figure out what ions are moving when you stimulate the neuron by changing the media inside or outside the cell. With wire, basically a wire in the axon because it's so big, and a wire on the outside, and then you could do experiments. And that's how they figured out the shape of the action potential, which is so fundamental of how our nervous system works.
Okay, the gods of neurophysiology. What was this last one? It was basically to look at these graphs and to try to get an idea of reading these.
Your graphs were a little bit easier than some of the other sections. Section 2 had a harder one, I think. But metabolic, it was basically, you see even the words up there, shrew metabolism and thermogenics, that already keys you into what's happening. So it's basically reading this and trying to understand it. And on your test, I think I wrote, activity gram was right here. So you already know that if the activity was higher during the night, that black bar, that they're nocturnal animals, right? And metabolism went up, which fits, right? Increased locomotion, your metabolism goes up. So that's what that was about. Metabolism goes up as the activity goes up. And you can see that they're nocturnal.
And then the other question, the other graph was just basically looking at what happens if you vary the temperature outside and body temperature. So what you see is that it generally pretty much stayed the same, right? The dots are all over, but generally if you drew a line through there, that's showing that it stayed pretty much stiff. So they're homeotherm. Plus, the shrew should give you an idea, too, right? Mammal. So, it, as the environmental temperature changed, it was able to maintain it. It means also it probably had to increase its metabolism, but that wasn't all part of that, right? So, that was those. That's those questions. So, that's it for the test stuff. And not bad. So, if you look back over the PowerPoints for the different, you know, classes that we had, we only have, I think, what, 5 PowerPoint slides up. You will see
some of those same figures copied and pasted, and that's what we'll do with the next test, too, copy and paste, you know, figures from the PowerPoint, and hopefully that gives you some sense of what we're going. Okay.